People are excited about what AI will do for them. At IBM, we're excited about what AI will do for business, your business. Introducing Watson X, a platform designed to multiply output by training AI with your data. When you Watson X your business, you can build AI to help coders code faster, customer service respond quicker, and employees handle repetitive tasks in less time. Let's create AI that transforms business with Watson X. Learn more at ibm.com/WatsonX. IBM, let's create.
Get ready for Season 4 of The Restless Ones, an original podcast presented by T-Mobile for Business and iHeartRadio. Join host Jonathan Strickland as he sits down for in-depth discussions with the people at the intersection of technology and business. You'll learn how each of these leaders is building a bridge to what's next and leveraging transformative technologies like 5G to create a more connected and meaningful future today. Listen to The Restless Ones, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I know I say this every week that I have a very special guest, but this week I really have an extra very special guest. His name is Jack Bogle, and he is the founder of the Vanguard Group and the inventor of the index fund. Did I oversell that this is a special guest or not? Let me tell you a little bit about how this date came about and what made this so interesting and weird and unusual. First, I've been chasing Jack Bogle for literally years, and he doesn't travel much. He's a homebody. He lives near the Vanguard headquarters. He's not much for coming into Manhattan and recording something like this. But we did the interview with chairman of Vanguard, Jack Brennan, about a year and almost 2 years ago, and that went really well. And then last year, we did, just about a year ago, we did the interview with Bill McNabb. He's the current CEO of Vanguard Group. And I started poking and prodding and asking, hey, when can I sit down with Jack? When can I sit down with Jack? And finally, I just said, we're willing to come to Pennsylvania and meet with you guys. And they said, oh, if that's the case, come on down. So you'll hear when we sit and talk with Jack, this was not the usual interview, partly because he's just a force of nature. And I try and balance between guiding the conversation to the specific questions we have and keeping us on track to cover a variety of topics and subjects. And you could pretty much tell when I give up about three or four questions in and just say, Jack Bogle is a force of nature. I'm just going to have a conversation with him and let it go. A little background on the day. This was a couple of Thursdays ago, and we basically left the New York area ungodly early. I want to say about 4:30, quarter to five, drove down to Pennsylvania. Actually, we left so early, we beat all the traffic, not only around New York, we got there before the traffic from Philadelphia. So I had my first Cracker Barrel experience, having breakfast at a Cracker Barrel, which apparently is very common outside of downstate New York. It was quite delicious. We get to the Vanguard campus about an hour early, spend some time in their galley, get at Vanguard. It's the staff or crew. The cafeteria is a galley. It's got all these nautical themes. And we're finally ushered into a small conference room off of Jack's office. And you'll hear during the interview, he's 86 years old. He is sharp as a tack, smart as a whip. His voice is still very strong, very powerful. And any pretense I had of following a script and trying to ask specific questions pretty much went out the window. So you'll hear me wrestling in the beginning. Some of the questions you'll hear me trying to keep him on our original script. And I, 10 minutes into this conversation, it's pretty clear, hey, this is a bucking bronco. Just try not to get kicked in the head. Keep feeding him questions based on wherever he goes. Just follow him and take it to where it goes. And all told, I thought this was really a fascinating conversation. He sat with us for 90 minutes. He was supposed to go to lunch with someone else. I'm pointing to my watch. He's waving me off like I'm telling him not to steal home. And he's coming in. He doesn't care. And so it ran a little long. By the time we back out some of the other stuff, you'll hear this is a substantive, lengthy conversation. If you are at all a Vanguard fan, a Boglehead, an Index fan, you are going to have a field day with this. I had to set this up because really it was such an exciting experience for me to spend 90 minutes with the man, the legend. Here it is, my conversation with the one, the only, Jack Bogle.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I know I say this every week that I have a special guest, but this week I have a super special guest, the one, the only, Jack Bogle, founder and chairman emeritus of the Vanguard Group, essentially the creator of the world's first index mutual fund for individuals in 1975. I could read your CV, which will essentially take up the entire show. There's so much stuff to talk about with you. You are a legend in the industry and maybe the person who has had the single biggest impact on investing of anyone, but let's just start from that beginning undergraduate thesis. You're in college in Princeton in 1951, and you're thinking about why do actively managed funds, why do so many of them underperform the market? How did that come about for a college student?
Well, it came about by a great accident, and that is I was majoring in economics. Mm-hmm. I was looking for a subject for my senior thesis, which is a requirement still at Princeton. It's an extensive document. Mine turned out to be maybe 135, 40 pages. And I didn't know what to write about, but I wanted to write about something that no one had ever written about before. And there in December 1949, I was reading Fortune magazine, which I did as part of my economics background, mm-hmm. just voluntarily. And there was an article called Big Money in Boston. And it was about the mutual fund industry. And it described this tiny industry, maybe $2.5 billion for the industry, mm-hmm. as tiny but contentious. And I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of tiny and I'm kind of contentious, so I'll write about it. And I wrote the thesis. It enabled me to graduate with high honors from Princeton. Pretty good job. Not a great thesis, but not bad for somebody a year out of his teens.
Let me push back at you and say that was a incredibly insightful thesis. The insight that you derived at a very young age is the cost of all this active management, they were unable to overcome that bogey. Even to today, what should really be so obvious to everybody, lots of folks still haven't seemed to figure that out. So what makes me stop and pause and ask you this question, how did you ever come to that conclusion at such a young age without the universe of information we have available to us today?
Well, to begin with, the thesis title was The Economic Role of the Investment Company. Mm-hmm. And the overriding focus of that thesis was mutual funds are there to serve investors. Mm-hmm. Put the investors first. And I talked about reducing sales loads, reducing management fees, focusing on investing and not marketing, things of that nature. And that's what the industry in my formula then would have to do to reach its great potential. And I did not actually, to be very clear on this, I did not assemble mm-hmm. any data. But I looked at about 15 leading mutual funds mm-hmm. and looked at their records. And without adding and dividing and getting averages, it was very clear that very few of them, if any at that time, could outperform the S&P 500 index. So it was basically anecdotal, mm-hmm. Although this industry in those days was very much a commodity in a way, kind of commodity. The major funds of those days were just basically buying long lists of blue chip stocks. Mm-hmm. You could call them Dow Jones Industrial Average funds, or later, because the S&P wasn't very well known then, you could call them Standard & Poor's kind of funds. Mm-hmm. They were down the middle. They had fluctuations, very similar volatility, very similar to the index.
So even back in the late 40s, early 50s, mutual funds were closet indexers?
Sure, absolutely.
That's quite fascinating. So let's fast forward a little bit. So now you're working as chairman of Wellington Management Company. And long story short, you said the most unwise decision of your career. You do a merger, doesn't work out, and they end up breaking you down from lieutenant to private, so to speak.
Less than private.
Less than private. And you wanted to run a fund, and they said, well, you know, because of this M&A, we don't want you running an active fund. If you want to put together – how did the index come out of that job change?
Okay, well, let me say my first job, and I was 35 years old, and Mr. Morgan, the founder of – Walter L. Morgan, the founder of Wellington, called me into his office. Wellington was in trouble. Wellington Fund was in trouble. Its performance was slipping, and Wellington Management Company was in trouble because we were basically a one-product, if you will, company, mm-hmm. a conservative balanced fund. We were, for the want of a better metaphor, the bagel of the mutual fund industry.
Mm-hmm.
The hard, not sweet, nutritious, safe choice in the biggest balanced fund in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And people stopped buying bagels and started buying, if you will, donuts. We came into the go-go era. And
so,
all these fancy growth funds, high-powered, buying stocks that had no investment, no intrinsic investment merit at all.
This is the mid to late 60s, the Nifty 50, and that sort of
this
set of changes.
This was the go-go era.
Yep.
And the go-go's came and the go-go's went. But if you're in the bagel business and nobody is buying bagels, and the balance fund share of industry sales actually dropped to 1%.
Wow.
And so I had to do something, and Mr. Morgan told me, do it. And I talked to a couple of firms about merging. And then I came across this firm in Boston that had a fund called iVest Fund, one of the go-go funds of the day.
Mm-hmm.
They had some apparently bright young managers that I had kind of common cause with. And they had a pension business. So we got the new managers that would save Wellington Fund. We got the go-go fund that we needed to stay in business.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into a new business that we thought we could be very successful in. It was, from words of one syllable, two syllables, brilliant.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My extra special guest today is Jack Bogle. He is the founder of Vanguard Group and essentially the inventor of the index fund. Jack, we were speaking earlier about how a crisis at Wellington, which was the predecessor you worked at to the Vanguard Group, actually led to the creation of the Vanguard Group. Tell us how that came about.
Okay, well, let's start with the fact that in doing this merger, which I was eager to do, I gave up too many votes in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so when everything fell apart, the market went down and so on. Right at as the market was going down in 1974, it would be a 50% decline. The happy partners fragmented. And there were four of them, and there was one of me.
Right.
And they had packed the board of directors. I was never very political. And they fired me. The guys that had caused this catastrophe fired the one that was trying to avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was out of a job. So what could I do? I could go try and find work for another firm. I had a young family living here. I didn't want to move. I was very angry about what happened, of course. But, you know, what is. And so I decided my best chance was to talk to the directors of the Wellington Fund. This fund so badly hurt the diamond in our crown, and say, look, the management company has fired me, but you're a slightly different group, can keep me, and we'll tell the management company what to do. We will be in charge of the administration of the fund, anything necessary to make it work, and we'll be in charge of appraising the advisor and taking whatever steps we want. We'll be independent of the advisor. And I wanted to take over distribution too, but the directors wouldn't go along with that. So we became a little administrative company. And I wanted a glamorous name, so I found the name Vanguard. When I first learned about, you know, we go from Wellington, the land battles of the Napoleonic Wars, the Duke of Wellington, to the naval battles of the Napoleonic War, and there's Lord Nelson. At the Battle of the Nile, one of the most complete naval victory in history to this day. And he writes at this dispatch that I see, from the deck of HMS Vanguard, his flagship.
And that sounds like a great name for a company.
Perfect. Perfect.
From Wellington Fund, how did you actually form the Vanguard Group?
Well, the idea was that the funds would create a new company that they owned. They would capitalize. Capitalization was very small. You know, I'm going to guess maybe $250,000. This was a very small company at that point. Actually, the total assets of the funds were down at around $1.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So we capitalized the fund, and Wellington Management Company had to take it because the directors of the funds were in charge of the contracts with Wellington. And
so you really backdoored your way back into the company after they had fired you as chairman.
Well, yes, I think that's a fair statement, but from a technical standpoint, I'd been the chairman of the Wellington Fund all along.
Gotcha.
So I have the same old continuity that I had going back to 1951.
Just post-merger, this was a backdoor. So how do you go from that to the Vanguard Group?
Well, we put a name in the company because we had, I think in those days, maybe a dozen funds, and we didn't want a dozen separate companies to manage.
Right.
So we had to have a core or central company and that would pool resources of all the funds and provide all the services. And we had allocation methods between the funds. And it was all good until we decided to take over distribution, which was our I'm a little bit ahead of myself. Let me go back and say to the first thing, we were not allowed to go into the business of investment management.
Mm-hmm.
That was theirs. We were not allowed to go into the business. That was theirs being willing. That was theirs being
so
willing.
So the active side, you couldn't do.
And we couldn't go into management. We didn't distinguish between active and passive.
Oh, really?
Not in those days. There weren't any index funds.
Right. So if you couldn't go into management, how were you able to set up the Vanguard 500?
Be patient.
Okay.
We were not allowed to go into distribution because that was Wellington's function too. So we had this little administrative company looking over, however, had the legal responsibility and the board responsibility to look over the advisor and distributor. So we were in charge. And so my first, I knew a company that was an administrative company was not going to be anything for me. I mean, I like the administration. I know how well it has to be done. Shareholder record keeping and all that. But that's just not the kind of challenge I was looking for. And any company that's going to succeed is going to have to control the kind of funds they want to run, the kind of distribution they want to have, who will buy the funds, who will sell them, things of that nature. So we have a company that's just in this little administrative box, and I'm thinking, let's do something. So at the very first board meeting of the new company, after we'd gotten organized, I say, we got to start an index fund. And the directors say, you're not allowed to get into investment management. And I say, this fund isn't managed. And believe it or not, they bought it.
So in other words, you describe the index fund as just, hey, it's the 500 largest companies in America. There's no manager. Nobody's in charge. It's just, it's an unmanaged broad index. And they said, oh, go do that.
They said, well, I won't say it was that easy, but that was the final decision.
I get the sense from what you've described that they were kind of, let's let Jack go do that. He'll be out of our hair. It'll keep him busy and fine. It won't cause anybody trouble.
I think you're pretty much on the mark.
This week on Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio, I have an extra special guest. His name is Jack Bogle. He is the founder of the Vanguard Group, the inventor of the index fund, and author of far too many books to mention. I've been speaking with Jack here in the headquarters of Vanguard, and just outside the conference room where we're sitting, on the wall is a framed print, and on that print it says, stamp out index funds. Jack, what on earth does that mean?
That means Wall Street couldn't make any money out of index funds.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wall Street didn't like it. We had an initial public offering. I went all over New York so many times to try and find underwriters and finally got the four largest retail underwriters, Bache, Dean Witter, Reynolds, forget who the other one was.
Bache, Dean Witter, Reynolds, okay.
They were the biggest guys in the business, and they said, we can do $150 million with this great new idea.
Mm-hmm.
They did $11 million.
So less than 10%.
And they came in to see me when the underwriting was over and said, you know, I said to them, look, we can't even buy round lots of all 500
right.
stocks. And they said, well, why don't we just give everybody their money back and pull it? And I said, are you kidding me? we have the world's first index fund. And it's the world's first index fund, period. You don't have to say retail. Right. With a lot of institutional holdings at the beginning. It's the world's first index mutual fund. No question about that. And
amazing.
And so it got nowhere. It went nowhere fast.
$11 million launch. What year was that?
That was in 1976.
Right. $11 million, and everybody laughed, and nobody thought there was any future to index funds.
That's exactly right.
That's just astonishing. Well, you had incredible foresight to say, and it makes sense that the four largest retail shops would want to participate in this, because this is a simple, easy way for their retail client to get exposure to the market fast, easy, relatively inexpensive.
It should have, except that when the client buys this fund, it's to be held forever.
Mm-hmm.
They don't trade it, and the fund doesn't do any trading. There's no brokerage business generated by the fund. So this was not a happy moment for Wall Street. And they looked at it, I think, as some kind of the beginning of a communicable disease.
Right.
And it had to be stamped out. The Center for Disease Control had to come in and...
Did they really perceive you as a threat, or did they kind of laugh it off and, yeah, best of luck with that, Jack?
Yeah, I'd say pretty much that way, although we did a couple of years ago for one of the fund's anniversaries. We all got together with the underwriters.
All four underwriters.
Yeah, all four underwriters and their lawyers and our lawyer singular. We only had one in those days. They're all good people, you know. And we all do our best in this life in very different ways of work. So it worked out well. It had to start, and it did start.
So here's the question that I could ask you 40-plus years later. Vanguard is now running $3-point-something trillion dollars. $4 trillion is not that far off in the distance. An enormous success, one of the single largest asset managers in the world. How come nobody ever said, hey, those guys are on to something. We should be a competitor to them. How did that never come up anywhere along the lines?
Well, the answer is so simple. Index funds have a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
All the damn money goes to the investors.
Right.
Managers can't take anything. They're not managing.
Well, but you're taking 10 or 15 basis points, and on trillions of dollars, that's not nothing.
Well, nobody expected to get to trillions of dollars, believe me, not at 11 million.
But okay, in 74, 76, it's 11 million. But by the time you get to the mid-1990s, you're hundreds of billions of dollars. And then I think you hit a trillion, was it late 90s? So even 97, 98, 99, didn't anybody say, hey, those guys in Pennsylvania, they have $1 trillion. Why don't we do what they're doing?
Well, it's a problem, and eventually the big guys had to. Fidelity had to have. Mm-hmm. They were dragged kicking and screaming in indexing,
mm-hmm.
and they have to be competitive on price. They can still make all the money they want, and it's an awful lot, on the actively managed funds. So it's kind of a loss leader for Fidelity.
And what about others? BlackRock and American Century and all these other entities. Schwab offers an index. It seems everybody offers some version of the S&P 500 index.
Yeah, well, T. Rowe Price is a good example. They have a hidden index fund. They don't talk much about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of expensive, 20, 25 basis points relative to our five. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a sideball thing so they can get into the retirement market. This has become a marketing business. And right now, we're seeing this tremendous change in people realizing the importance of low cost and a long-term focus. And if you just keep those two things in mind, you will never do anything but own a broad market index and hold it forever.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My extra special guest this week is Jack Bogle. He is the founder of the Vanguard Group, inventor of the index fund, author of numerous books. Let's jump right back into the issue of costs and how they impact investors. You're known as the person who created the index fund, but really, which do you think is more important, the passive indexing or the fact that it's so low cost?
Well, it's pretty clear to me that passive indexing is the more important, because I'm going to define cost in a couple of different ways here.
Okay.
One is the expense ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And our funds, index funds, probably average about 10 basis points. Our managed funds probably average about 35. So there's not that big a difference. The industry is up around 120 on an unweighted basis.
And when we talk about basis points, a basis point is just a percentage of, so 100 basis points is 1%, 10 basis points is 1/10 of 1%. If you're averaging 10 basis points, that's a very, very inexpensive.
It's 5/100 of 1%.
5 basis points, 5/100 of 1%. That's very inexpensive.
That is really inexpensive. But that's because we have a mutual company owned by its shareholders and don't have to deliver profits. And think about this for a minute, Barry, that the profit margins in this business can easily run to be 50%. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a 1% expense ratio, you're making 50 basis points on the top.
Mm-hmm.
So you're actually operating at 50, which is probably not too bad, because very few people have the scale that we have developed,
sure,
have the technology that we've developed, have the efficiencies that we've developed, and also, I don't think this is self-serving, have the bully pulpit that we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagine Fidelity coming into this business. I describe that as drag kicking and screaming to the business.
Mm-hmm.
So here we have kicking and screaming over here, and here we have missionary zeal, the bully pulpit, by this is the way. This is the new way.
And you have an entire universe of evangelists amongst the advisor community who have drunk the Kool-Aid and say, hey, low-cost indexing is the way to go. Following the financial crisis, it seems like Vanguard was sucking up all the money in the room and everybody else wasn't also ran. Are events like the Great Financial Crisis, does that sort of shake people out of their false belief and send them in the direction of, hey, these missionaries, turns out these guys are right?
Well, you're certainly right in a sense. It's not easy to read. But what happens when the market goes way down, it went down roughly 50% in 2007 to 2009. And all these managers that says, we'll manage your money for you, the shareholder is kind of led to expect that they will anticipate this and not let it happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
They may not directly communicate that. But if someone says, well, I'm pretty smart, I'm a smart manager, you would expect that in the down market, they would do a good bit better than the market. Well, of course, to begin with, they can't, because some do and some don't, and they're
right.
All average together.
And how are you picking one over the other? You never know in advance. You can only guess, and what good is that?
Yeah, exactly. So the down markets do help that. But it's also this wave of, you know, there's not an economics course, there's not an MBA course in investing or finance that doesn't say basically indexing is the way. It's the data that matters.
Mm-hmm.
It's the data. And it's going to, so instead of, I mean, usually if you look back and see a fund that's done well, you can pretty much conclude it will not do well in the future. Everything reverts to the mean.
Right.
The index does not. It continues to give you your share of the market return. And when you look at the numbers, I mean, one of my favorite constructions is the index fund gives you the advantage of long-term compounding of returns,
mm-hmm,
while eliminating the tyranny of long-term compounding of costs. So think about it this way. Let's assume the stock market gives a 7% return over your life, over 30 years or over 50 years. If you get the 7%, each dollar goes up 30 times. If you get 5%, that would be the 7% less the industry's typical 2% all-in cost, you get $10.
Wow.
So $10 versus $30.
Huge difference.
So you put up 100% of the capital, you took the 100% of the risk, and you got 33% of the return. And as I say to people, if that strikes you as a good deal, by all means do it.
So Morningstar once famously did a study, which I'm sure to this day they regret. And the study, they became, you know, famous for their star rankings of mutual funds. And I've written about this. You could Google this. People can find this. Someone internally did a study and said, if you don't have access to Morningstar data, but you just looked at a single data point across the universe of mutual funds, what would be the most helpful? Would it be the track record? Would it be the manager? And it turned out that if you forgot about everything else and only picked the lowest cost funds, that generated the highest returns going forward. So how that makes me ask the question, how important are keeping costs low to investors?
Well, when you give the statement that it's only cost that matters, I'm inclined to say, as the kids would say, Barry, duh.
It seems obvious after the fact, but for the longest periods of time, people – so let me digress and talk a little bit about hedge funds. While all this money is flowing to Vanguard over the past decade since the financial crisis, you guys went from $1 trillion to over $3 trillion. The other segment of the market that attracted a ton of money was the hedge fund industry, which charges 2%, forget 5 basis points, 2% of the assets under management plus 20% of the profits. And they also scaled up across 10,000 funds to $3 trillion. How do you explain, despite the obvious duh, how do you explain so much money flowing to a group with such high expenses?
Well, greed, mm-hmm. The buyer's greed, and perhaps even the manager's greed, because those are very high costs. But people are looking for a better way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty easy. I've done a lot of work on this. You may have read some of it, to forecast what the stock market return is going to be within reasonable magnitudes over time, not year by year, but over decades. Mm-hmm. And so you know where you're going to be roughly in the stock market, and you say a pension plan. And pension plans are a very heavy part of the hedge fund business because they don't have to worry about the high taxes generated by hedge funds. And so they say, we've got to have more. And someone comes and shows them their past record. And guess what? They put the S&P 500 to shame. Mm-hmm. Of course, they wouldn't show you the record if they didn't. So
a little survivorship bias built into that?
Yeah, sure. There's survivorship bias built into it. But most of all, it ignores the fact of life in this business. It's everywhere. Reversion to the mean. Mm-hmm. Biblically put, Barry, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. And it happens to hedge funds. It happens to mutual funds. It is basically a fundamental law.
7 fat years, 7 lean years, and there's no way around it.
Yeah, the number of years may differ, but you've got it.
All right. Well, you referenced the Bible and that phrase that always stayed with me. So let's stick with the issue of indexing for now. And I want to quote something that Charlie Ellis had wrote. Charlie was not only on the board of the Vanguard Group board of directors, but he was also an advisor to the Yale Endowment Fund. And he wrote a wonderful book called Winning the Loser's Game, and he also advocates that individuals should stick with simple indexing, which leads me to a question: how many indices should the average investor own?
Well, very, very few is the simple answer to that question. You need a broad stock index, and you need a broad bond index, because I'm convinced that everybody should have a little anchor to windward when these bad times come, if for no other reason, to protect themselves and getting emotional and behaving badly and selling out their portfolios at market bottoms. So leaving aside the allocation between stocks and bonds, you can buy a bond index fund, and you can buy a total stock market index fund, and you can buy the Standard & Poor's 500 index fund, and that's basically 85% of the market. You would think that the total stock market would be a better bet because it's more diversified than the S&P 500. But we're in a time right now, and I don't know if this is durable or not. Nobody does, where the large companies are doing better than the small companies. Mm-hmm. So the great Mr. Buffett he's leaving his wife's estate 90% in the Vanguard S&P 500 index fund. He has a bet with some hedge fund managers.
He's winning. He's winning the bet.
He's not winning it. He's killing them.
He's absolutely way, way ahead. They actually had to create derivatives for this bet. This is a real bet with millions of dollars
exactly.
At risk on it. And it's a runaway. Nobody else is even in second.
Well, he's got a year to go.
That's right. It'll be a decade after the financial crisis. The hedge fund, for those of you who may not be familiar with the infamous bet, a bunch of hedge fund managers were arrogant enough to bet Warren Buffett that they could outperform the S&P 500. He took that bet, and it's not even close. It's really an amazing story. I didn't realize we're only a year away from the final outcome of that bet. And it's theoretically possible they can win, but really, mathematically, it's highly improbable that they'll be able to.
I think it's very improbable.
Highly improbable.
Anything can happen, however, I concede that.
Jack Bogle, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. This has been absolutely fascinating. For those of you who are interested in hearing the conversation continue, be sure and check out our podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting. You can check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome back to the podcast. Jack, thank you so much for doing this. This has really been tremendously fascinating. It was worth the drive to Pennsylvania to come see you. I'm absolutely fascinated by everything you've accomplished. So we've talked a little bit of the advantages of indexing for equities, and you mentioned bond funds. There have been some pretty reasonable academic arguments that you could do okay with active management with bond funds because there's such a universe of choices. It's not just treasuries, but it's treasuries and it's corporates and it's municipalities. How do you feel about bond funds? Do you just own a broad index of bond funds, or do you look at active management in bonds and say, well, maybe there's some value added there?
Well, as a group, bond managers cannot win because they are the market.
Right.
And so they will, as a group, capture the market return. There's just no question about this. And charging as they do, probably in the mutual fund business, probably 60 basis points, 70 basis points, they just don't have a fighting chance over the bond fund index. Now, that index has some issues, as they say. Mm-hmm. And I started the first bond index fund, by the way.
What year was
30
that?
Years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, 30 years ago. And it's done just fine, met the test of competition. But I think we can do better in bond indexing than the bond index the way it's constructed. Because it's about 70% treasuries and good mortgage-backed,
right,
government-backed instruments. And I think most investors should not have 70% in the super safe category. Mm-hmm. I think something like 30% is pretty good.
So it should be a better assortment of risk that potentially is generating more returns, and as long as you're holding it for decades, the short-term volatility is irrelevant.
Yeah, well, the one that I happen to use myself is our intermediate-term bond index fund. Mm-hmm. It's just as volatile or as non-volatile because it has the same duration or average maturity, but it's about 35% governments, mm-hmm. and it is the same in every other respect. So if it has a higher yield, the yield in a bond has a 91% today's yield, a 91% correlation with the return you're going to get in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. So you might as well take advantage of it. And I'd say particularly, I mean, yes, it's a little riskier, but today people are dying for income. And to reach a little bit, I mean, I don't believe in big reaching for yield at all.
Well, that certainly was a cause of problems in the last financial crisis.
Right.
Everybody who reached for yields and said, I understand this is subprime, but the rating agencies tell me it's AAA, so I'm going to hold my nose and buy this. Didn't work out that well.
It did not work out well.
To say the least. So I didn't realize you had created the first bond index fund. So we have bond indexes, which you would like to see have a little more risk and a little less of the super safe size. We've already discussed the equity side. Let's talk a little bit about some of the hot buzzwords that are going around today. And I'm curious, as I already know what your answer is going to be, but I feel obligated to ask.
Before we get to that, can I just say one thing?
Sure.
We also started in about 1987 to broaden our index base from the S&P 500. We'd started the bond index fund. We then started, I realized that there was a certain attractiveness to owning the whole market. So we started something called the Extended Market Index Fund.
How many holdings are in that?
Well, probably right now, it varies amazingly. But probably right now, 2,500.
All right, because the Wilshire 5000 is something like 3,400 stocks.
It's even less than that. It got up to 7,000, believe it or not.
Late 90s.
Yeah.
Well, we were cranking out a lot of new companies before we realized that Pets.com wasn't a sustainable business
exactly.
model.
So I also had an idea that growth might do better than value for young people investing on a dollar averaging basis, and wouldn't be that much riskier. And when they retired, they might want an income fund. So I divided the S&P into two. As soon as the S&P did that, I started a growth index fund, half of the S&P, and a value index fund, the other half. Mm-hmm. Didn't work out very well. I mean, it worked out fine from a performance standpoint. What we found is the money poured into growth when growth was doing well.
At the wrong time.
And out of growth and into value. So, you know, sometime I think we've got to be very aware of creating things that we know investors are going to use badly.
So,
we don't tell them what to use and how to use it, but it happens, and it's a responsibility of us, the sponsor, to do that.
So that raises a really significant question, which is, how important is investor behavior to long-term returns, and what can the average investor do to make sure that they don't shoot themselves in the foot?
Well, the first thing to do is don't chase performance. If some salesman, or you read in the paper for that matter, I don't need to blame the salesman for this, it says here's a new manager on a new fund and it's really doing great, or an old manager and the fund is doing great, and this fund has a great 20-year record. Turn away from that, because its next 20 years aren't going to be anywhere near as good as its past 20. There are plenty of examples of that, with all due respect to my friends up in Boston. Fidelity's Magellan Fund was a star fund for roughly 20 years.
Fantastic. And Peter Lynch, and then one of his successors did really well. Peter Lynch was a superstar performer, and then what happened?
Well, with a tiny little fund, too. Don't forget that. And a fund that wasn't even offered to the public for 5 or 6 years.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting.
We all have our little secrets. And so I think overrated, but Peter Lynch was certainly a good manager. But, you know, his principle of, you know, if you see a product you like, buy the stock, you know, makes no rational sense, I'm sorry to say. And Peter Lynch also, at Magellan Fund's heyday, said, in words of one syllable, in Barron's, most investors would be better off in an index fund.
I read that. Was that Barron's? I know I read that from him
somewhere. And that's not a concession. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have him saying that. You have Warren Buffett saying that. We have a number of people.
David Swensen.
Swensen at the Yale Endowment. Yep. He's another one. It's amazing that people push against this, because it's long-term and boring and there's nothing to talk about. But I guess that leads to the next question. Should investing be long-term and boring?
If you want to have a comfortable retirement, believe me, you'll be less bored in your retirement if you got plenty of money. you'll be so unbored if you don't do it that you'll have to go back to work.
So let me ask you about some of the hot buzzwords that are out there in investing these days. And again, this is a cheat because I'm pretty sure I know what your answers are. But I feel obligated to ask this. So your index funds are basically put together by market cap weighting, but now there's something called smart beta, which is different ways of assembling an index that don't rely on cap weighting. What do you think of the idea of smart beta?
Smart beta is stupid.
Okay. Tell us why.
Well, I mean, I didn't say that's what Nobel laureate Bill Sharpe says. Mm-hmm. I just quoted him. And the reason is just think about this for a minute. It's another form of active management to begin with. But if smart beta is good, and that means it beats the index, then dumb beta does even worse than the index, right?
Right.
So smart and dumb are different. But why are people going to be dumb if it's so easy to be smart? It's just another claim that I can do this better. Now, happily, after WisdomTree and Rob Arnott's fund came out a decade ago. His fund is now more than 10 years old. Mm-hmm. What happened? And the answer is essentially nothing. His fund beat the S&P 500 by, I think, 30 basis points, but it was 20% more volatile, and therefore its Sharpe ratio, the relationship between risk and reward. Don't hold me to the numbers, but the Sharpe ratio of, let me just guess here, I won't be too far off. The Sharpe ratio of the 500 was like 41, and the Sharpe ratio of Arnott's fund was 36.
Okay.
So he lost. He had 10 years to prove it. Now, maybe he'll prove it in the next 10 years. Who can say? But why would that be? I mean, where is all the brain power? He's a very smart guy, by the way, one of the smartest guys in this business.
He was a guest on the show, one of our earliest guests. He's a delightful gentleman. I always enjoy his company. And it was really an insightful thought to say, let's think of different ways to put together indexes. But your position is this isn't after fees, after everything else. Once you now you risk adjust it, you look at all this volatility, your conclusion is this just isn't worth it.
Well, and even if you look at absolute returns, it's like 30 basis points better over 10 years. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not trivial, but when he has essentially the same portfolio as the index fund with different weightings, mm-hmm. You can't expect anything to be too different. So I think it's oversold. Jeremy Siegel of WisdomTree described this as the new Copernican view of the world. Everybody had it wrong. And Copernicus said, oh, by God, that sun is in the middle, and the new sun is smart beta. Mm-hmm. Can't be, because we're all as a group average. And if there are these smart guys over there, there are dumb guys over there, in smart and dumb both in quotes.
And so net-net, when you're buying smart data, you're really buying a distribution of really smart guys, really average guys, really dumb guys, and you don't know who's who across all the smart beta funds.
Yeah, and then think about this one step further. The index essentially guarantee the dollar value index essentially guarantees you the return that all investors share. So that's written stone, mm-hmm. Etched in stone. Smart beta may do a little better, may do a little worse. What's the point of taking the risk when the guarantee of getting the market return is right at your hand? Why would you speculate? Why would you speculate on maybe this guy can do it better? And believe me, some of these smart beta funds will, for a short period of times, will do it, and some of them won't. I mean, that's the nature of the beast.
I've described it as, why do you want to romance alpha and forsake beta when beta is a sure thing?
Yeah.
So that's smart beta. Let me ask you about something else that I suspect I know your answers. This year, commodities have gold especially has had a huge bounce back. We saw a tremendous commodity run from the early 2000s till 2011. What are your thoughts on things like commodity funds, gold, and energy for investors?
No, no, and no.
No, let's repeat this in case those of you missed. Gold, no. Commodity funds, no. Oil funds, no. Tell us why.
Okay, well, oil is a commodity. I'm speaking of oil as a commodity now. Mm-hmm. And that is, think about what a stock is.
Okay.
A stock has an internal rate of return, and it's composed of the earnings growth and the dividend yield mm-hmm. when you buy it. It's there. If the stock goes up and down, that return is there. It has an underlying internal rate of return.
You have a discounted cash flow from the future. Exactly. You're buying an existing business that's going to generate revenue and profits, and you get to participate in that.
Now take a bond. Mm-hmm. It has an internal return equal to the interest coupon that you're going to get over the next 10 years or 25 years, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. Commodities have no internal rate of return.
And there's a cost of storage and security for things like gold or oil.
So when you buy a unit of gold, why do you buy it? Because you think you can sell it to somebody for a higher price. Mm-hmm. That is the definition of speculation.
That's the classic greater fool theory. You may have paid a lot, but someone will pay more.
And, well, I mean, you may be right, by the way. There's no reason you can't be right, but that just means the other guy is wrong.
And you don't know, as you as the investor, you don't know which of those two parties you're going to be 5 years from now.
Yeah, and another thing when you mentioned gold it brings to mind is everybody used to talk about gold. Forbes magazine highlighted it in all their reviews for years and years when they picked the best fund. Gold funds. And then we had the boom in gold. And then we had the collapse. Mm-hmm. And nobody talked about gold. Now we have another boom. And everybody's talking about gold. Then gold collapses last year. Nobody's talking about gold. Now gold is up this year. Everybody, this is metaphorically speaking, everybody's talking about gold. You know, don't pay any attention to gold. I mean, it would not be stupid. I wouldn't do it, but it would not be stupid to have a very small position in gold as a hedge against worldwide hyperinflation, mm-hmm. maybe 5%. I wouldn't do any more than that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you should do that. But it's at least defensible because you have a specific goal in mind. And
it's insurance. You're paying a 5% insurance on the remote possibility of global hyperinflation. But if you're wrong, it's a giant 5% drag on your portfolio for the next few decades.
Yeah, and that's huge.
That is. Well, you guys are talking about 5 basis points. This is 500 basis points. That's a tremendous, tremendous drag. Let's talk a little bit. And by the way, I'm pretty much what I expected you to say about commodities. Let me find two things to talk to you about that I'm going to have to push back a little bit. One is ETFs, exchange-traded funds. I know you're not a big fan of them, but lots of investors find it's a very inexpensive, simple way to get exposure to the S&P 500 or whatever asset class they want. Why are you not a big fan of ETFs?
Well, I'll start with a little anecdote.
Okay.
A wonderful guy named Nathan Most came to visit me in 1992, right in my office upstairs here at Vanguard. And he said, I have a great idea for you. I want to start the first exchange-traded mutual fund and have Vanguard as my partner. There I was. I could have not only created the first index mutual fund, but the first ETF. And I said, Nate, no way, because the description that you got from Nathan, or at least their first ads later on, was now you can trade the S&P 500 all day long in real time. Mm-hmm. And I would say,
that's a
what
bad idea.
Kind of a nut would want to do that? I mean, there must be better things to do than that in this life. But in any event, it's the trading idea. When my idea of indexing, broad market indexing, buy the S&P 500 and hold it forever. Mm-hmm. What is said to be Warren Buffett's favorite holding period.
Is forever. So the idea of an S&P 500 fund that if you're gonna do that exposure, you're better doing it with a low-cost mutual fund than an index fund, than an ETF, so there is no temptation to trade intraday or to play around. That's not what you think people should be doing with their time.
Oh, not, but let's examine the ETF business for just a minute. And that is, if you look at ETFs, all the big ones, man, I can't look at all of them, but the big ones particularly and the normal ones are about 70% owned by financial institutions. They're trading them in the marketplace every
right.
day. The SPDR, the S&P 500 ETF.
Or the NASDAQ 100, the
well,
QQQs.
Well, the SPDR is the most widely traded stock in the world mm-hmm. every day. And if you look further, this year, which is a little more volatile than most years so far, the dollar volume of trading in ETFs is the same size as the dollar volume of trading in common stocks.
Wow.
Unbelievable, because common stocks are worth about $23 trillion, mm-hmm. and the SPDRs are worth about two. So SPDRs are turning over at 3,000% a year, and stocks are turning over at 200% a year, something like that. So they're trading instruments owned by large institutions. I mean, look at the SPDR ad that says, institutions, here's what you need to trade. I mean, it's practically verbatim from the ad. It may be irrelevant, but I don't think in the long run that has anything to do with the mutual fund business or individual investors.
And it certainly shouldn't have anything to do with individuals, because why would you as an individual want to trade against these giant institutions who do nothing but use this as either a trading tool or a hedging tool or whatever it is? You're saying this is not a playground for individuals to step into.
And that looks like it's roughly 70% of the business. And, you know, I don't even to criticize it. It's kind of irrelevant. When you get to the other 30% of the business, and I may be a little off in my percentages here, but they're individuals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something like two-thirds of them are using ETFs to trade. And one-third of them, that would be 10% of the total, all the ETF market, are using them, buying and holding them, and maybe using them. You know, we have, it's a funny technical thing in this business, but, you know, if you want to put in $1,000 a month into a Vanguard fund, and then you want to take out $5,000 at the end of the year to buy Christmas presents, whatever you might want, mm-hmm. It's very difficult to do that here, because we don't like buying and selling at the same
right.
time. You can do it with our ETFs very easily. So there's a certain marketplace there of people who aren't traders, but like the flexibility that ETFs have. And I have no problem with that. The other part of the problem, however, the ETF problem, is there is this huge amount in number, not so much in assets, of funds that are doing things that no intelligent investor would ever do. Mm-hmm. Triple leverage, and you can bet every day whether the market's going up or down. Isn't that grand?
not only triple leveraged up, but inverse triple leveraged as
well. Sure, as long as you know whether the market's going up or down during the day, you're going to make a fortune.
Who knows if the market's going to go up any or down any given day?
Well, I guess these smart people that have these funds, but they all have both of them.
That's right.
They don't compete with each other, and there are a whole lot of other wacky things. I mean, I don't think U.S. investors, I'm sure you're going to come to this, should be buying individual foreign, non-U.S.
So let's ask that question. A lot of the academic data says that if you're diversified internationally, parts of the world are sometimes doing better than the U.S., and sometimes the U.S. is doing part of the world. If we want to really be diversified, you need U.S. and not just have an overwhelming home country bias, developed world ex-U.S., and then emerging markets. What's wrong with having a smattering of those in your portfolio so that you get to take advantage of the growth of the Pacific Rim and China and South America and et cetera?
Well, the question is it an advantage? I mean, tell someone to put all their money in Brazil 2 years ago.
Okay.
Tell somebody who put in all their money in China a year ago. Is it an advantage, or is it just, you know, kind of a little bubble going on in those countries?
Well, but you're not picking individual countries. You're going to have a broad index of international companies, and therefore it should theoretically, the gain should offset the losses and then some, and so you have exposure elsewhere. You're not a big fan of that.
Well, I'm not, and the reason goes back to when I started to think about it seriously, writing my book, Bogle on Mutual Funds, back in 1993-94.
Bogle on Mutual Funds. Let's see what I have here. I have Common Sense on Mutual Funds.
That probably says something very similar to this, but this is a little more recent. So I said,
10th edition, forward by David Swensen. So when you say recent, this originally came out almost 15 years ago, right?
The original was 1999.
Okay, 17 years ago.
Interestingly enough, I'll get back to the other subject in a second, but interestingly enough, the first book came out at a market high. And the second, 1999, and the second book came out at a market low, and I would hardly change one word in the whole second edition.
Really?
I reprinted it verbatim, and then Mark put red, Nantucket red, for any changes that took place in the book.
Now, on the 10th edition, that's used after the financial crisis. You could see some of the changes that were made, but they're really very modest. You really didn't change any of the themes in this. You just kind of fleshed it out post-crisis.
It worked. Indexing worked in the good market. Indexing worked in the not so good market, and cost low cost worked in the good market and not so good, and also in the not so good market. It has to. So getting back to, I said in my first book, look, U.S. companies get half of their revenues. This is true now, at least a little bit less than half of their revenues and half of their earnings from outside the U.S. You have an international portfolio. Why do you want a larger one? And then I say, take a look at what comprises that international portfolio. Your largest investment is Japan. Your second largest investment is the UK. Your third largest investment is France. Now, if returns are developed out of national economic strength, does anybody think that the UK and Japan and France are going to do better than the US in the next 10, 15, 20 years? I can't imagine it. And now, I may be wrong. I'm not saying this is written in stone. But that's 45% of the money. So if people knew they were putting 45% of their international money, so-called international, non-U.S. is a better formulation, in Great Britain, France, and Japan, I mean, every one of those economies has real problems. The French don't work very hard. The Japanese have a structured and deeply aging economy overburdened by future retirement claims.
Right. Terrible demographics, and they're a great exporter, but they have issues.
And Britain doesn't know what's going to happen if they do the exit from the European community, and nor do they know what's going to happen if they stay in.
So what would happen if a sharp upstart company, let's call them Vanguard, says, here's a broad international index that's fairly evenly weighted. It's not just these three countries. Might that change your perspective, or do you still think, hey, you get plenty of the S&P 500, half the revenue comes from overseas, that's all the overseas exposure anyone really needs?
I don't like the idea, because you would have as much in, I don't know, Honduras
right.
as you do in Great Britain. It wouldn't make any sense.
Right.
So, but to make matters worse, when I made this statement in 1995, we now have 22 years of history.
Right.
How was the prediction? And the answer is that, don't hold me to the exact numbers, but the U.S. portfolio is up about, say, 750%, mm-hmm. and the non-U.S. portfolio is up about 275%.
So the U.S. is still winning versus the international.
So I committed the ultimate sin, Barry. I was right. Now, I want to be very clear on this. Does that mean I will be equally right in the future? I can't imagine it.
You think eventually mean reversion comes in,
yeah.
and eventually those two positions will reverse, the U.S.
will Well, I don't think they will reverse, but I don't think that spread is a durable spread. And the reason I don't think they'll reverse is we have this fabulous economy here. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, it has problems, but probably less problems than any country in the world.
No doubt about that. And this is my favorite quote is, this is the cleanest shirt in a dirty hamper.
Sure, exactly right. And, well, I mean, I'd say it was even cleaner than that. We're number one in innovation and technology. We're number one in entrepreneurship. We're still a great manufacturing company, although not as great as we were. And we still have, you know, all these new companies being started, existing companies being run more and more efficiently. And more than anything else, or at least as much as all that, we have great institutional structure in this country. We have legal protections. We have courts. We have laws. No one's going to take your stock away from you, confiscate it overnight. And shareholder rights are as good as any country in the world, maybe with the exception of, I don't think they do any better, but they don't do any worse. Probably Switzerland and Great Britain would be the two big competitors.
You see what happens in China. Your stocks may not be your stocks. It's very hard to be. Forget as a local, as an international investor, it's very hard to be an investor in China if you don't know, am I going to be able to ever cash this out? Or maybe there's going to be a vacation period where no sales for the next month, as we saw last year.
Yeah, and let me add to this that just about everybody says I'm wrong, by the way. Mm-hmm. But everybody said I was wrong about indexing.
I was going to say that's only going to make you double down and think you're right, because there's a track record of people predicting you're going to be wrong, and they've all proven themselves false. So,
but let me just say one more thing in international. Just think what you would have done if you had an internationally weighted or a non-U.S. weighted in 1989, mm-hmm. when you had 50%, that is to say 50%. Of your money in Japan.
Right, when the Nikkei was 46,000 or so.
Yeah, something like that. No one was talking this way then, but that could happen again. And I don't think you should be subject to these funny speculative booms that can take place in other mm-hmm. countries. I just can't imagine that there will be a significant advantage in international companies over U.S. companies. I'm not talking about stocks now. I'm talking about companies and economies. Over the U.S. Now, look, I could be wrong on this, and if you think I'm wrong, go buy all the international, all the non-U.S. stocks you want. Buy a non-U.S. stock index. Buy individual countries. I wouldn't do any of that.
Mm-hmm. And what we didn't even mention, the currency side of things. How significant is currency fluctuations to this sort of international exposure if you're domiciled here in the U.S.?
What kind of?
Currency.
Currency, sure. Well, that is an issue because the dollar has been very strong, and it won't be strong forever because international trade has a way of balancing out. When the dollar is strong, the trade balances change and all that. So I don't think you should count on a strong dollar forever.
So won't impact it. Let's talk. I want to talk a little more about Vanguard, but before we get to that, two last questions about indexing. The first is, is there any sort of active management you would favor? You know, Vanguard, about 30% of the assets here are in active managed funds. What do you think about having a small slug of someone's portfolio in something that might not be a passive index?
Well, let me give you this very important background about our actively managed funds. And this is what I've been saying since we started Vanguard in 1974. I want our actively managed funds to have returns that are relatively predictable, relative predictability, relative to their group, like large cap value funds or mm-hmm. long term municipal bond funds, whatever it might be. The idea would be look at those funds and don't get too far out of line. So you'll have an average performance. If you have six managers, there's where the multi-manager thing comes from. Mm-hmm. If you have six managers, the idea that they will do about the same as your competitive group with 60 managers is almost guaranteed to do the same. So what's so good about that? What's so good about that is we think we have a 1.5% to 2% cost advantage through lower expenses, lower turnover, no sales loads, and we should win by 1.5 a year, not on brilliance, but on cost.
So
that's guaranteed. Now, let me just give you the punchline here. Mm-hmm. If you win what's so good about 1.5% over 10 years, you have a 20% higher return.
That's tremendous. So I previously interviewed your CEO and chairman, Bill McNabb, and one of the comments he had made is that he still felt there was room to squeeze costs lower. You guys are $3.5 trillion. Is there a floor on how low costs can go, or are you eventually going to run out of efficiencies?
Well, we have yet to squeeze costs lower because our costs go up and up and up.
But as a percentage, you can squeeze them a little lower on a per
dollar
invested basis.
I certainly don't want to disagree with our CEO, but it's not we're squeezing, but we're the captive of the market. Mm-hmm. If the market goes way down, our expense ratio is going to go up. Mm-hmm. There's no way we could squeeze enough out of our expenses if we had 15% less assets. Mm-hmm. So we should be very careful about expenses, and we are. I think we're managed in a very strong way. But the expense ratio is a combination of something we can control more or less, how much we spend, and something we can't control at all, the level of the stock market. Mm-hmm. So the expense ratio is a mystery whether it go up or down. Now, if it goes way down, it's going to mean we have very good markets.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. Can indexing ever get too big, or can indexing ever take over the market, as some people have alluded, or is there a place for a combination of indexing and active managers in the actual marketplace?
Well, it's not in the nature of things that indexing could be 100% of the market. Mm-hmm. If it were, we would have chaos. There would be no valuations. There would be no liquidity. There would be no anything. So what are the chances that indexing get to 100%? Zero. Right now, it's, I think, around 28% of the total market, 35% of the mutual fund industry, of the equity mutual fund industry. And so it means that hunk of business is, in broadly stated, just removed from the turnover level. So if the turnover were 100% and the end market were 50% indexed, the turnover would go to 50%. I came into this business when turnover was 25% and everything was fine. It's going to take a long time to get to 50%, a long, long time, and maybe never gets there. So when you put reality in the face of the theory that if everybody indexes, then it's going to be it's just not going to happen. But the other thing is, people follow this statement by saying, if the market gets more and more indexed, then it will be less efficient and we'll be able to beat it more easily. No. Unequivocally, no. Some will beat it. Some will lose to it if the market is less efficient, and the winners and the losers will average the market return. There's no way around that.
So that leads me to a quote of yours, and I have to ask you about it because I find it's fascinating. You once wrote, "The stock market is a giant distraction to the business of investing." Explain.
Well, investing is about the long term, and investing is about earning what I call the investment return, which is the dividend yield when you go into the stock market and the earnings growth that follows. That's investment return. The market return also has a speculative return, and that is the price earnings multiple of the valuations high or low when you come in. And if they're high, they're going to detract from that return, and if valuations are low, they're going to add to that return, because the low will the valuations, the price earnings multiple, reverts to the mean perfectly. It's about what it today, although it's a little bit higher than this today because the market's hardly inexpensive, but the reality is it's just about the same level it was in 1900. So we had ups and downs, booms, busts. In the long run, speculative return is zero. So concentrate on the investment return. Forget the speculative return, which is very difficult to predict, and just get what business can give you. Now, if you look every day, you're apt to do something. And one of my basic rules is don't do something, just stand there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been doing that this year, I think you're a lot better off. This is a tough year so far. Not that bad. I mean, I think the S&P is off about 3.5%. It's really nothing. Although you'd think it was the end of the world. So it's don't let the stock market moves distract you. They are a tale told by an idiot, these moves, daily moves, hourly, minute-by-minute moves, a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury signifying nothing.
I have a bunch of questions that I ask all of my guests, but they're all specific to each individual because they're so so detailed. So who are your early mentors? I know in one of your books you mentioned somebody, you thanked somebody who you had mentioned in the earlier part of the conversation. Who do you think of as mentors?
Well, outside of my teachers, my first real grown-up mentor was a guy named Jim Harrington,
mm-hmm.
who was a graduate student and engineer at Princeton University, and he was running the Athletic Association ticket office. And when he stopped doing that, he pulled me out of the crowd and asked me to run it for him.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to do a job, and I learned how to do it with integrity, and I learned how to do it with on time, and I learned how to do it with keeping my emotions out of it.
This is just selling tickets to Princeton students for
football, basketball, baseball, whatever it might be, particularly football.
And that was a seminal experience to you and helped form your own character.
He had just a great sense of business values. And like all engineers, he was, you know, they kind of go step by step.
Right.
Sometimes it's not all that exciting, but it's always right.
Structured, organized, and
you're dealing with a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure. Well, Princeton Stadium is how many people? That's a...
Well, that was the old Palmer Stadium. That held 50,000 people.
Right. And now it's almost double that size. It's huge, isn't it?
No, we went way down. We're about 28,000.
Oh, you went the other direction. Okay.
And we can't fill it now. Every game I worked was a sellout.
Right. That was back in the day. So that was really quite an education. You dedicated Common Sense on Mutual Funds to Walter Morgan. Who is he in your pantheon?
Well, he was the greatest of my mentors. He hired me. He read my thesis out of Princeton. He wrote, I think, a little bit over the top, that Mr. Bogle knew more than he did about than we did about the mutual fund industry.
Really?
And so he liked it, and he was a Princetonian himself, class of 1920, and I was the class of 1951. And I watched him work. He was very much a Renaissance man, interested in investing, interested in marketing, probably less interested in the detail of the business, shareholder record keeping and stuff, which was so much simpler those days.
Mm-hmm.
But also a Renaissance man in terms of his interest. He was a outdoorsman, a hunter, a fisherman, things that I don't do at all. And but he had a high sense of standards. And he, as I said at the beginning, turned the company over to me when I was 35 years old. So he must have had an awful lot of confidence in me. And I saved Wellington Fund finally for him after this catastrophe I described mm-hmm. earlier. We told Wellington Management Company how we wanted it run. And they've been running it that way ever since. It meant much more focus on income and income stocks and less focus on growth stocks. And it's worked out. We had a whole renaissance of the Wellington Fund. And he saw a lot of that. And he died but the year that book came out. And a little bit before, but I had shown him the title page with his name on it. He was very pleased, and very pleased with the revival and renaissance of his wonderful Wellington Fund. I felt I had a moral obligation to save it.
So what about other investors? Who has influenced your thought process, your philosophy, perhaps not your approach to investing, but what other investors have colored your worldview?
Well, you certainly start with Benjamin Graham.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically ground zero, and The Intelligent Investor, his book, I happen to like the fourth edition, which is much more into the, I think it was 1974,
mm-hmm.
Has much more about mutual funds and things of that nature, and he's very clear on that, and so he would certainly be one. Mr. Morgan, Mr. Morgan had a couple of associates, Joe Welsh, the president of the company, and Andy Young, his lawyer, very quick-witted, smart guy. And they all saw something in me, don't know what it was, that gave them confidence that I had the judgment to do the job. And another, interestingly enough, another one of my great mentors was the man who, when I came on the Investment Company Institute Board of Governors, he was the chairman. His name was D. George Sullivan, and he was executive vice president of Fidelity.
Oh, really?
And we had a great relationship.
That's fascinating.
And so he would have been, you know, if people have confidence in you, they bring out your best. Mm-hmm. And he really did. And Mr. Morgan did. And Mr. Welsh did. And Andy Young did. So those would be the big names, I think.
Both as mentors and investors. Let's talk about books. You've written your fair share of books. What other authors' books, be it on investing or what have you enjoyed? What books would you recommend to people?
Well, I've already mentioned the
Intelligent Investor by Graham.
Yeah, Intelligent Investor by Graham. I think Bert Malkiel, who's a friend of ours and friend of mine and former director here for many, many years now, no, really the best director we've ever had, outside director. His Random Walk Down Wall Street, which is updated every couple of years, is another. David Swensen's book on for the individual investor is really superb. Peter Bernstein's Against the Gods, top of the line.
I just read that over the holidays. Yeah. Fantastic book.
Yeah. Well, he was a very gifted man. We were very close, Peter and I. And we had our little disagreements here and there, but overall we were on the same team. And then Bill Bernstein, Four Pillars of Investment Wisdom, is a wonderful book. And it's hard for me to go a lot beyond that, to be honest with you.
Well, that's a great starting list right there. You could certainly do worse than any of those half dozen books. We've talked a lot about how you've changed the industry since you began way back in the 60s and 70s. How else has the industry changed that you think is either for the better or for the worse? What stands out as to how finance has evolved over those years?
I think when I came into this industry in 1951, it was a much better industry than it was thereafter. The big part of that change was in the go-go era. When we had this idea, we went from investment committees, prudent investment committees, buying blue-chip stocks, to portfolio managers, comets, and not stars,
right?
Comets that burn out and their ashes drift gently down to Earth. And that's happened to so many comet managers. I mean, you could hardly lose count. You wonder, I mean, the real superstars just don't stay there. You know, I always used to wish Bill Miller well. He's at Legg Mason. He beat the market, I think, 16 years in a row.
Right.
And every time I saw him, I'd say, good luck. Good luck in the future. I liked him. My wishes of good luck didn't do any good at all.
He very famously imploded and went from literally the top performing fund to the bottom 1% following the financial crisis. What had worked for him previously just eventually stopped working, and he got caught in a lot of paper that turned out to be not worth what he thought it was.
Well, in an earlier era, you remember Gerald Tsai, who ran Fidelity Capital Fund, and he had the best record in the business. He goes out and starts his own fund, a Manhattan fund. Gets a huge underwriting. It was $400 million. Nobody's ever seen anything like that in this business. That was the old days. And it had, after 10 years of operation, the worst record in the mutual fund industry. And, you know, I tell people, when you think about the nature of securities markets, it's just as difficult to be last as it is to be first.
What was his
think
name
about
again?
That's
amazing. What was his name again?
Gerald Tsai, T-S-A-I.
T-S-A-I, great. So some of my last few questions, you've mentioned a lot of things have changed since 1951. What do you see as changing in the future?
I guess I'd say, not to beat the phrase to death, reversion to the mean. I see the industry going back to its roots, much more of a fiduciary focus.
I hope so.
I'm very much in favor of the fiduciary rule, although someone else is going to have to work out the details that seem to make it difficult to operate. and put it.
It shouldn't make it difficult to operate, because all you have to do is ask yourself as an advisor one question: hey, is this in the client's best interest? And if the answer is no, you can't do it. It's much simpler than the complicated suitability rules, which have all sorts of ifs and thens and clauses. Best interest of the client, yes, you can do it. No, you can't. What could be easier?
Well, you unfortunately need kind of documentation how you're doing things and all that. It is a little laborious because we have to have, you know, a lot of lawyers work on this. And you and I have the spirit of fiduciary duty, and they've got to get to the letter of it. And it's more complex than it ought to be. But it's coming. And, you know, with so many funds being flashes in the pan, investors are going to learn by their own experience. You know, I was told this was a great fund, and it was a great fund for 2 days, and that was the end of it. And we overestimate our own ability to pick funds and stocks. We overestimate the ability of our managers to do better consistently. And if people just got the idea of reversion to the mean again and again and again. You know, we were looking at some data the other day, Barry, and if you're in the top quartile for a given five-year period, only 15% of you are going to be in the top quartile in the next five-year period. And if you're in the bottom quartile, 15% of you will be in the top quartile in the next period.
And over time, that sort of returns don't help anybody. I think it was Howard Marks who said, if you're consistently in the top 40%, over time, that puts you in the top 10%. But you have to be consistent. You can't be a shooting star, outperforming, underperforming. You have to be top 40. But he runs a distressed bond fund, not necessarily a stock picking
fund. Let me add this, if I may. What is the objective of the individual investor? It's to have a lifetime of investing for a lifetime. And for a young investor, believe it or not, a 25-year-old investor has a 70-year life expectancy. 70 years, they're going to be 95, they'll probably be 100. So what's the best way to invest for 70 years? If a mutual fund manager lasts for 7 years, that's the average, you're going to have 10 of them.
Wow.
The average fund goes out of business 10% every decade, 50% every decade, excuse me.
Really? It's that high? That's amazing.
Yeah. And then the new guy comes in and sweeps clean.
Right.
Managers get fired. There is no way, none, zero, that if you own three or four mutual funds, which is typical, there is no way that over 70 years you have even a fighting chance to beat the market. And if you do the index fund, I guarantee you that you will have the same non-manager 70 years from now as the non-manager you have today.
So that raises a really interesting question, which happens to be coincidentally one of my last two questions. What advice would you give to a millennial or a kid just graduating college today, beginning their career? What would you tell them about what they should do with their career, and what would you tell them about investing?
Well, people have to find their own way in this life. And I've talked to a number of groups at Princeton, one on religion and business, and one on ethics and business, two separate groups. And one is a small seminar, and one is a large lecture course. And I get that kind of lecture. Should I not go into the financial business? And I say, no, go into the financial business and make it better than it is today. You know, people have to find their own way in this life. I had to find my own way. Barry, you had to find your own way. There's a lot of bumps along the way. You got to have a little resilience. Mm-hmm. You got to be able to take defeat and turn into victory. I think that's what I've done, maybe a little bit.
And to say the least.
And so it's this field is going to shrink hugely. There's no question about that.
It already has just since 2009, no doubt about it.
The combination of technology and the knowledge and the spread of this disease called indexing is not going to go away. It's habit forming. It's catching. It's contagious.
It's spreading. And my final question, and I feel awful that our 90 minutes is already up. I'd like to continue going for another 90 minutes. What is it that you know about investing today that you wish you knew when you started in 1951?
Well, I'd say quite a bit. I mean, I was on the Wellington Fund Investment Committee, and I saw what hard it was to beat the market. I wouldn't have told you that back in 1951. And I worked for a long time with John Neff, who had many, many years of success in beating the market. But he's an exception, And even his record and in the later years deteriorated. But then, I mean, he's not running Windsor Fund. He ran it for 30 years, I think. But he's not running it anymore. So managers come and go. So I'd say things like the power of compounding, the beauty of keeping costs low, need to ignore the market, the need to do something, are all things that have, and the difficulty. This is a very, very hard business, this business of investment management. And in the long run, we're all average or below average, as my thesis suggested, below the market averages. And so don't think it's easy. Don't think you're smarter than anybody else. Just get in the middle, get costs out, and don't peak.
John Bogle, this has been a fascinating conversation. I, again, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. If you enjoy this conversation, you can look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes and see the other 80 or so of these that we've had. Be sure and check out all the rest of our chats. They're really quite fascinating. I have to thank Mike Batnick, my head of research, for helping to put together all these questions. My producer and engineer, Charlie Vollmer, for dragging himself out of bed at an ungodly hour in the morning to drive here to Malvern, Pennsylvania, to Vanguard Mothership. Jack, thank you again so much. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Great to be with you, Barry. Good luck.
On October 24th, join top technology leaders, business executives, innovators, and entrepreneurs in London for the Bloomberg Technology Summit. How can unprecedented digitization help solve global challenges? Speakers from Graphcore, Siemens, Deliveroo, and ABBA Voyage will explore the rapid advance of AI and green technology and delve into the escalation of cyber warfare and more. Learn more at bloomberglive.com/techsummit2023.